I think we're good to go. So a couple of pieces of housekeeping. Number one, that this is our last session on Qohelet. We pretty much finished.
No, on Daniel.
Sorry, on Daniel. Sorry, thank you for the correction. We'll get to Qohelet in a moment. Last session on Daniel, we are going to, we have one more sort of postscript that I need to address, and that's the topic for today's shiur. And we finished the discussion on the last prophecy about Hanukkah and about the Chashmonaim and the Greeks and the story of Antiochus, and spent some time discussing why it was so important for Daniel's vision to reach up to and including Hanukkah, and the aftermath of that we'll see in today's discussion. By way of housekeeping, a note: today is, because today's the last class, next week we're taking a break, so there is no shiur next Tuesday. You kind of get a 1 week reprieve before you get invited back to the next series. And the next series, we're starting in the beginning of Chodesh Elul, will be an in-depth study of Sefer Daniel. Sorry, I'm very confused. An in-depth study of Sefer Qohelet. Qohelet, also known as Ecclesiastes. Qohelet is a puzzle. It's an enigma. It's a code. It's all kinds of fun things. And we're going to figure it all out and try to make some sense of it. And, again, I like to follow, the approach that I learned from my teachers, Rabbi Dan and Rabbi Yoel Ben-Nun and others who have published on Sefer, Qohelet. We will explore that. That is going to be also be a somewhat of an ongoing series, or will probably take us till through the end of December, is my guess. And then we'll figure out what we do from there. But that is the plan. So hold on to your hats for that one, and you'll be invited to re-register and welcome back for it. And I hope we'll see you. I hope you'll join us, because it's going to be, if anything, it's going to be fun. That's for sure. All right, so let's jump right into share screen. And actually, you know what? Before I do that, I need to do one little piece of housekeeping. 1 second. Okay. Share screen. Can everybody see the screen? Yes? Good. Thumbs up. Excellent. All right. If you can leave your cameras on, it's helpful to me. If not, I understand. We are in the last piece of Perek Yud Bet. We kind of finished the prophecy and the part of it in terms of his description of the Maskilim and the Bnei Brit and those who are loyal to the Brit and those who abandon the Brit, and the whole conflict between the, as we understood it, between the Hasidim and the Mityavnim, between the Hellenists and those who remain loyal to Judaism and to the Brit of Torah, even to the point of personal self-sacrifice. And we connected that to the whole theme of Sefer Daniel, which is about personal sacrifice for Jewish life, for Torah, even in beyond the context of just the three primary prohibitions of idolatry, adultery, and murder. And in this last reference of the book, he makes reference to something which is really quite unique in Tanakh as a whole, not necessarily unique to us in terms of theology, but very unique in terms of Tanakh. And that is a reference to what he refers to as Rabim Mishene Admat Afar Yakitsu. Those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. So let's understand what he's talking about. Perek Yud Bet, Eit Hayi Yamod Michael Asar Agdol Omed Obnei Amecha, Michael, the Sar, the prince, the angel who looks over, guards over your people. There will be a time of trouble. Right? Eit Tzeva Shaloni Yata Miyot Goy. Ad etahi, right? Trouble unprecedented, as we talked about last week. Uba etahi malet amcha, and those who and your people will be rescued, will be spared. The story of Hanukkah, as we understand it, kol nimtzak ketuv b'sefer, as written in the book, and which book, again, is a discussion in the Mepharshim. But now we're going to leave that. Many of those who sleep in the dust shall awaken. To everlasting life. And those to reproach and everlasting abhorrence, meaning to devastation or to punishment. Now, I already tell you the Mepharshim, just a technical issue, the Mepharshim were troubled by the question. If you're talking about the resurrection of the dead, why are you talking about the resurrection of the dead and some will live forever and some will not? I understand that he has two groups of people that he's referring to in the story of Hanukkah, the maskilim, those who are wise, those who are loyal to the Brit. They will shine, Yizasiru Kizoa Harakia, like the firmament, Matzteke Arabim, Kikochavim Olam Be'ed, and those who bring many to righteousness, they will shine like the stars forever and ever. But what about this other group? So some of the Mepharshim suggest, and I think it makes sense in terms of the Pshat, what he really means here is that those who are maskilim, those who are righteous, those who are bright, those who are in this category, they are the ones who will awaken for eternal life. And the others who do not awaken, they will remain in the dust of the earth, which is the simplest way to understand this verse. Daniel concealed these words, sealed the book until the appointed time. Many shall run back and forth, and knowledge shall be increased. Then Daniel has this small conversation with the Malach, and then at the end, again, we have the following reference. Daniel, God, Daniel, the words are concealed and sealed until the appointed time. Many shall purify themselves, make themselves white, make themselves refined. But the wicked shall be wicked, and will not understand. But those that are wise shall understand. Again, there's those two groups that we talked about in terms of the events of Hanukkah. And the very last sentence, V'yata lech lekeitz, you, Daniel, go to the appointed time, v'tanuach, rest, v'ta'amod l'goralcha lekeitz hayamin, and stand for you up again in your portion at the appointed time when the end of days. So several references in this text seem to allude to the notion of what we refer to as Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead. The reference to, in Pasuk Bet, V'rabim mishene admat afar yakitzu, many who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awaken. And again, the last Pasuk of the entire Sefer, for V'yata lech leketz, you go to the end, V'tanuach, rest, V'tah. And you will once again rise to your lot at the end of days. Daniel is the only book in Tanakh that makes specific, direct, almost explicit reference to the concept of the resurrection of the dead of Tchiyat HaMetim, which raises two profound questions. Why is it here? What's its message here in the book of Daniel? And why is it so rare as a concept, as a reference in Tanakh? Just to put it in perspective for a moment, the phrase, V'rabim mishene admat afar yakitzu, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awaken, is a phrase that we should be familiar with. It should kind of roll off the tongue, because that's precisely what we say in the Amidah every single day. That the bracha of gvura of atagibor gvura, which refers to resurrection of the dead, atagibor le'alam Hashem mechayim etim ata, right? That you resurrect the dead. There, the reference is umekayim emunato li shene afar. You who are loyal to your promise to those who sleep in the dust, which again is a reference to mechayim etim, the resurrection of the dead, and that's precisely that language comes from. This book, this reference in Sefer Daniel, Perek Yibet, Pasuk Bet, Rabim Mishenef Admatafar Yakitzu. Now, To be clear, there are places in Tanakh where there is a reference to somebody who dies and is brought back to life. And that's not unprecedented. That, in fact, does appear in Tanakh. Specifically, there are three such stories that appear. Two are more familiar to us. The third is less familiar to us just because it's not a Haftorah to be read. But the famous one, of course, is Eliyahu, and when he goes to hide after the drought that he declares, and he's hiding by the widow, and the widow asks him what should pray, and she has a child, and the child dies, right? And Batomel Eliyahu, she says to the came to pass after these things that the child became sick. The child had no life breath left in him. She says to Eliyahu, "What have you done? Why have you come? You've come to make to highlight my sin and to cause my son to die." So Eliyahu says, "Give me your son," and he takes him up to the attic, and there, of course, we have the famous description of him lying upon the child. Are you also going to bring evil upon the widow with whom I sojourn by taking her son? He stretched himself out on the child three times. Vayikra Lashem, calls out to God and asks, "Tashovna nefesh hayelid hazel kirbo, bring this child's soul back to life." And God listens. Vayishma Hashem b'kol Eliyahu v'tashov nefesh hayelid, and the child is brought back to life. Vayechi, and he lives. Similarly, you have, that's the story of Eliyahu. You have almost an identical story by Elisha, Eliyahu's Talmud, which is in Malachim Bet Perek Dalet. That's also a Haftorah. And there you have an even more graphic description. Came to the house. I skipped a pasuk. Elisha goes to this child, closes the door, he lies down, and he kind of puts his face against his face, and he stretched himself out upon him, and the child's flesh grew warm. And the third story of resurrection of the dead that you have in Tanakh is in Malachim Bet Perek Yud Gimel, also related to Elisha. There, the context is that Elisha, as he is at his burial, Yamot Elisha, and they buried him. There's a band of Moabites coming through the land. Vayhem Kovrim Ish, came to pass, they were burying a man. They cast the man into the grave of Elisha. As the dead man touched the bones of Elisha, and he was revived and stood upon his feet. And the king of Aram looked, and he was amazed. And the rest of the story is as it unfolds. So there are three such events in Tanakh, but I want to be clear about something, and this is very important for us. The three events that are in Tanakh that relate to the story of, I'm going to actually stop sharing for a moment, that relate to the resurrection of the dead are all specific instances where there was a need relevant to the story at hand that brought back a particular child to life, or person to life, meaning it wasn't a part of a kind of a historical moment, a sweep of history, a messianic moment, a picture of a reward and punishment for Israel as a nation, as a people, etc. It was a very specific instance. Eliyahu had one instance, Elisha had two instances of a specific individual or child for very specific reasons and messages related to, relevant to that context of that story. But the notion, as we understand Tchiyat HaMetim, as a kind of those who are righteous will be resurrected, as Daniel describes, right? V'rabim mishenei afar admat afar yakitzu. Many, those who are righteous, the maskilim, those who are loyal to the Brit, they will awaken, whereas everybody else will remain that kind of schar ba'onish, that kind of reward and punishment system of Tchiyat HaMetim, that has no other reference anywhere in Tanakh. The only thing that comes close is the prophecy of the dry bones of Yechezkel, and there are so many ways to interpret that story. Is he really talking about resurrection of the bones of dead people? Some say it's a metaphor. Some say it's a prophecy or vision. Some say it actually happened. Others suggest that it's simply a metaphor for the revival of the Jewish nation out of the graveyard of exile, meaning not dead people coming back to life, but the Jewish nation as a whole, dormant in exile for all of these centuries, and the process of redemption being described by Yechezkel as the process of returning the nation of Israel. As Yechezkel himself says, that these bones are Kol Beit Yisrael Hema. They are a metaphor for the house of Israel. So whether he physically brought them back to life as a symbol or whether he saw it as a vision, debatable. But in all cases, this kind of messianic picture of, at some point in the future time, these people will be brought back to life as a kind of reward for their righteousness, that has one single reference in Tanakh, and that is in Daniel. Now, it's profoundly relevant to our tradition, oral tradition. We're going to see that in a moment. But in Tanakh, it's rare. So there are essentially two questions that we need to address in today's discussion. Why is it so profoundly important theologically in our religious frame of reference for us to believe in the concept of the resurrection of the dead on a national scale? Right? On a national scale, number one. And number two, why is it so not prevalent and not mentioned anywhere in Tanakh except in one reference in Sefer Daniel? So I actually want to start with the latter question. I want to start with the question of why it's not in Tanakh as a whole. Why does Tanakh almost ignore the issue of the resurrection of the dead until the one reference in Daniel? This question is raised by Rav Medan in the end, the last chapter of his book on Daniel. I think he offers a very profound and very important answer, which we're going to try to unpack in the remaining time that we have. And that is that there is a underlining theme in the context of the book of Tanakh as a whole, which is a kind of a battle against a culture of the sanctity of life, or the preservation of the sanctity of life in a culture that of shvichut damim, of murder, or of a culture that try to diminish the sanctity of that life. If you go back to the early stories of Bereshit, okay, after Adam and Chava are removed from the Garden of Eden, which we'll talk about in a moment, what's the very first crime humanity commits? Murder. Kain in heaven.
Killing of heaven.
Right? Murder. Kain in heaven. It's the very first crime that humanity commits after they're removed from the gun. From there until the next piece of the story is the story of the flood. And the degeneration of humanity, generation after generation, for 10 generations until you reach the generation of the flood, where it says, "Vatimalei aretz chamas," the land was filled with violence. There is an undercurrent within the Torah that says that the Torah's battle is against a culture that diminishes the value of human life. And the Torah, if anything, starts with the principle that the human being is created in the image of godliness. Contained within the human being is an element of godliness and of Tzelem Elokim. And therefore, the sanctity of human life is absolute. The story of the Akedah, even the story of the Akedah, which was a battle against a culture of the time of Molech and other such cultures of child sacrifice, was essentially a way of teaching Abraham that whatever faith he was trailblazing into humanity was a faith that was not based on this particular, right? Take your child and sacrifice him was what everybody else was doing. And at the last minute, to pull him back from that says, no, that's not us. It's kind of a culture, and if you actually take a look here, I'm going to share screen again for a second. If you take a look in the aftermath of the flood, in Bereishit Perek Teth, in the aftermath of the story of the flood, the Torah establishes one basic principle. And that one basic principle is, Shafech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech, ki b'tzelem elokim asat ha'adam. The worst crime that a human being can commit is the crime of murder, of taking another human being. Because the human being is created in the spirit of godliness. And therefore, the human being, it has an element of sanctity in it. So why is that relevant? It's relevant because if you consider for a moment the concept of reward and punishment, the ultimate message of reward and punishment being the resurrection of the dead, and if that's part of this picture, of this eschatological picture of messianism, that those who are righteous will come back to life, one of the dangers it conveys is a kind of a diminishment of the sanctity of life as we have it right now. Meaning, imagine for a moment a culture, and it's not hard to imagine such a culture. Imagine for a moment a culture in which the sense of resurrection of the dead was so prevalent and so much part of the structure of the theological structure of a society that essentially a person comes along and says, if I kill somebody, well, not so terrible because it's only temporary. At the end of the day, the person comes back to life. So murder, life is not permanent. Right? This life is only a temporary one to the next one. And therefore, if somebody commits murder, then the culture, the society as a whole creates a certain tolerance for crimes that are considered abhorrent by the Torah, precisely because we rely too heavily on the flip side, which is, oh, well, the person will just come back to life. So it's not really I'm not really killing them permanently. And you create a society in which the value of life is diminished. So from that perspective, it is, and this is what Ramadan writes in the Sefer, I think it's very powerful. The notion of resurrection of the dead is not part of the Torah's depiction of reward and punishment. Neither, by the way, is any reference in almost any reference in Tanakh to concepts such as the world to come, Olam Haba, or Gehenna, or hell. Heaven and hell there's no conversation about them in Tanakh. There's one other book in Tanakh that addresses them on some level, and that's the book of Kohelet, which is our next unit of study. Right, but fundamentally, the Torah's concept of reward and punishment is on a national scale and in this world. And from the Torah's perspective, death is permanent. Right? You could make an argument from the Torah's perspective that death is permanent, and therefore murder becomes so much more evil because of the consequences that it has. Now, on the other hand, this is the second half of our discussion. Right? We do believe in the immortality of the soul. We do believe in the resurrection of the dead. We do believe in a world to come as a system of reward and punishment. And so what the flip side is, why are they so fundamental to our theology and yet so lacking in the world of Tanakh? So that's what we'll come to in a moment. But the question that just on this level, in terms of Tanakh, Torah Shebichtav, in terms of our understanding, the question that we haven't addressed is why Daniel? Right? So if that's the case, why does Daniel actually reference Tchiyat HaMetim explicitly? And I think that has to do more with the unique messaging of the book, as we explained last week. Daniel introduces a concept which is really unique in the language of Tanakh, namely the notion of personal self-sacrifice for the broader case and the broader sake of Jewish life, the continuity of Jewish life. The notion that these maskilim, that are yazhiru, that are righteous, that will shine, that matzdikei rabin, that they will bring others to righteousness by virtue of their own sacrifice, that notion, which is unique to the stories of Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, and unique to the story of Daniel, willing to put his life on the line for the sake of Torah, that's a new concept in Tanakh, and a new concept, therefore, in the story of the struggle of the Chashmonaim, the struggle of the Hasidim against the Mityavnim. Because of that, it raises a very profound question, which is, these deaths cannot remain deaths in vain. And so it's here that Daniel has to articulate, in a same sense of comfort, that they are sacrificing themselves for the sake of Jewish life and matzdikei rabim, etc. For the same, in the same breath, Daniel says, don't worry, their death is not permanent. There is a sense of continuity. There is a resurrection of the dead. There is a world to come. There is an eternity to the soul that is relevant specifically because we've introduced for the first time the notion of those who gave their lives on Kiddush Hashem for the sake of the Jewish people. This is the first safe for which that's become a real, or prophecy in which that's become a real prevalent force in Jewish life. And so in the same breath, that's where Daniel says, okay, that's true, but it's not about diminishing human life, which is the danger in the Torah, in the context of the Torah. It's about elevating their sacrifice and recognizing that what they've given up for the sake of the continuity of Jewish life. And here the reference to Rabbi Mishnei Afaya Kitsu, the notion that that sacrifice is temporary and not permanent, becomes so important for us here. All right. So that's the first half of this discussion, which is more or less why ultimately reward and punishment on any level, whether it be spiritual, or Lam Haba, the world to come, whether it be Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, why they are not centerpieces of the Torah's articulated expression of reward and punishment. In the Torah, it's about the Jewish people and about the nation of Israel and about society, establishing a society that is a light unto the nations, rather than an individual sense of reward and punishment. There's much more to unpack there, which we will, Bezrat Hashem, in our study of Kohelet. So it's kind of a dovetails into our next subject or our next book. But what I wanted to explore for the time remaining is the flip side of this question, which is, so why is it so prevalent and so important in the theology of Torah Shebaal Peh? Why is it, on the one hand, not recorded in Torah Shebichtav, and on the other hand, it is very important. We say it every day in our davening. Every single day, three times a day, we stand up in the Shemana Esrei. V'ne'eman ata la'achayot metim. We trust you, God, that you will resurrect the dead. That's the belief. So on the one hand, it's profoundly important, and on the other hand, it's not enough. And that's the tension that we struggle with. So let me walk you a very superficial kind of review of the sources related to Tchiyat HaMetim and kind of get a sense of its position. And part of this is to recognize that the concept, the Jewish concept, our understanding of the concept of Tchiyat HaMetim is not necessarily, as people might think, connected to the notion of messianism or redemption. And that's what I want to start with two separate concepts. So, for example, let's look at this Gemara in Sanhedrin, right? First of all, let's ask the basic question. We have a fundamental belief in the resurrection of the dead. We say it in Shmoneh Esrei, V'ne'eman ata la'achayot metim, trustworthy are you, God, that you will resurrect the dead. you are faithful to restore the dead to life. Baruch Ata Hashem Mechayim Metim. We say a blessing about it. You, God, will revive the dead. First question. When? When? When do we believe that's going to happen? And to whom? So to whom is easy. To whom we already established. Those who are righteous. Those who are deserving. When? So the Gemara, there's an interesting machloket here. Fascinating difference of opinion. Rashi makes reference to Gemara and Sanhedrin. Rashi there states that the resurrection of the dead will happen kishiyavo ha-mashiach v'yichaye ha-metim. When the king, Mashiach, will come and he will resurrect the dead. And Rashi connects the notion of messianism, redemption, as we believe, right, which all the Nevi'im spoke about, and the concept of the resurrection of the dead as sort of one process. The reference of the Gemara in Sanhedrin is to a particular discussion about a matter of halachic ritual related to the temple sacrifices. And there the Gemara says, Hilchot al-Mashicha, why are you paskin, that this is a particular way you do shechita, but we don't practice shechita anymore because we don't have the temple. So what are you paskining rules for the Messianic period? And the Gemara says, yes, we need to understand, we need to study and receive reward just for the sake of study. To which Rashi says, what does Hilchot al-Mashiach mean? What does it mean, halacha, for a time of the Mashiach? Says Rashi, kishiyavo Mashiach v'chayeh ha-metim. Mashiach will come and resurrect the dead. So says Rashi. But you should know, and I think most people, if you ask them, most people will perceive, or if you have this discussion, most people think, I would imagine, that the concept, the Jewish concept of the resurrection of the dead is somehow tied to messianism, somehow tied to the redemption story, to Mashiach. However,
is it tied to Olam Haba?
So again, what it's actually tied to, we don't know because we have no idea how it works. But we're going to see in a moment that at least according to most Rishonim who follow the Rambam, who disagreed dramatically with this position of Rashi. The Rambam writes the following, and I want to start with this position. Rambam writes in the laws of the kings, and he's talking about Melech Mashiach, this notion of messianism and redemption. Al yaleh al da'atcha she'melech ha-mashiach tzirich la'asot otot muftim. Don't think for a minute that the Messiah or Mashiach, in order to fulfill his mission as Mashiach, has to do any kind of wonders or signs or create any kind of new reality in the world, m'chadesh dvarim be'olam, or m'chayeh meitim, or to resurrect the dead. Says the Rambam, that is not the job description of the Mashiach. That is not the case. Don't think for a minute that any aspect of nature is going to change in the time of the coming of the Mashiach, or yeshum chidush b'maseh b'reshit, there'll be any change in the order of the world. Ella, says the Rambam, olam k'minago noheg. The world will continue in its current practice. So open up parentheses. So what is messianism? So the Rambam then goes on to explain. Our topic is Tchiyat Metim, but just be aware. The Rambam then goes on in his next sentence to say, to quote a Gemara that says, "Ein ben olam hazel yamot haMashiach ela shiyabud malchuyot bilvad." The only difference between the world we live in today and the time of messianism is Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. That we will not be under foreign subjugation, foreign rule, but we will be under our own independent political sovereign nation, Shibud Malchuyot. That, to the Rambam, is the definition. And the other roles that the Mashiach will play in terms of ingathering of the exiles, the spiritual revival, rebuilding of the temple, but the profound message of the Rambam is those are natural processes of history. They are not supernatural changes to the world around us. Now, in terms of messianism, that's a huge debate. The Ramban argued with this Rambam, and he quotes a prophecy in Yeshayahu about the wolf will lie down with the sheep. And the Rambam says that's a metaphor for peace amongst the nations of the world. It's not about a change of nature. Huge debate between the Rambam and the Ramban over this question. But with the exception of Rashi, what they agree on is that the concept of the resurrection of the dead, Tchiyat HaMetim, is unrelated to the concept of redemption of Biyat HaMashiach. Now, I'll show you an interesting proof that we follow this position. We have, articulated by the Rambam, we have this concept of the 13 principles of faith. The Rambam articulates those 13 principles of faith in his commentary to the Mishnah and Sanhedrin. We recite them in a poetic form as part of Yigdal every Friday night. Many people recite them at the end of Shacharis in the morning when they daven. They are in years after the Rambam. The Rambam didn't write the Ani Ma'amin, but many years after the Rambam, somebody wrote a poetic summary of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith, and they are what we refer to as the Ani Ma'amin. And I want to show you the difference in language of how the Ani Ma'amin is written. And I apologize, in the source page, the English translation got pushed to the next column. So if you're looking at the English, it's in the next column. I just want to read the Hebrew for a moment. Actually, for those who came in a little bit later, I'm going to repost the source pages here. Ani ma'amin be'emuna shlema, I believe with perfect faith, b'viat ha-Mashiach, and the coming of the Messiah. Ve'af al pi she'itmamea, and even if he tarried, im kol zeh, nonetheless, achakelo b'chol yom shiyavo, I anticipate and wait for his arrival every day. Every day could be a day in which Mashiach could come. Now, the Rambam includes Tchiyat HaMetim as a separate number 13 in the list of the Ikarei Emunah, but it's listed, but it's written differently. Ani ma'amin b'emunah shlema she'tiyeh Tchiyat HaMetim, I believe with faith, perfect faith, that there will be a resurrection of the dead. Be'et she'aleh ratzon me'et ha'borei yitbarach shemo, at any point in time in which God chooses. It's a fascinating difference in language. When it comes to Mashiach, I anticipate his coming every day. Chakelo, we're waiting for Mashiach. We're not waiting for Tchiyat HaMetim. There's no reference to waiting. There's no reference to it could happen any day. It's whatever God chooses. And in fact, that's part of the liturgy around these two concepts, separate them. For example, there's a Gemara in Shabbos that says that when a person enters into his personal judgment in the next world, God will say, one of the questions he will be asked is, Tzapita li Yeshua, did you anticipate, did you wait for the redemption every single day? And the Ran there explains, it means, Tzapita li Yeshua b'yamecha, did you hope, did you anticipate, did you at least believe that it was possible? Did you do what you could to bring about the redemption of your people in your days, b'yamecha? There is no such concept when it comes to the resurrection of the dead. We don't act towards it. We don't do anything actively to bring it about. There's no concept that if we, right? It's completely separated from the concept of messianism. Look at the Shemoneh Esrei. We started with the reference to the Shemoneh Esrei. Take a look at the Shemoneh Esrei for a second. The concepts of messianism, of redemption, which include the ingathering of the exiles, which includes the rebuilding of Yerushalayim, the rebuilding of the temple, the restoration of the seat of kingship of King David, they are all part of the central blessings of the Shemoneh Esrei, which we recite and articulate what we call bakashot, requests. We ask God to fulfill this every day, to blow the shofar of our redemption, to gather our exiles around us, to bring back a restoration of justice and punish the wicked and reward the righteous, and to rebuild Yerushalayim, Bnei Yerushalayim, and to restore the seed of David at Tzemach David Avdecha Me'era Tatzmiach, bring back the seed of David, Matzmiach Keren Yeshua. But nowhere in this central section of the Shemoneh Esrei where we ask God to do anything, and the extension is by what we are responsible to do as well, is there any reference to Tchiyat HaMetim? Tchiyat HaMetim, the notion of resurrection, is in the beginning blessings where we talk about the characteristics of God. What is God? God is somebody who, something that, right, is capable, mechakel chayim, who brings sustenance to living every day with kindness, who resurrects the dead with kindness and rachamim, who supports the sick, who's the fallen, or who heals the sick, matir asurim, who frees. We have a list of things that God does. It's part of his gevurah. It's a description of God's character, that he brings life, gives life, supports life, and is capable of. Right, trustworthy, that at some point in history, some point in the annals of humankind, there will be a concept called Mechiyat HaMetim, but it is totally unrelated to the concept of redemption and messianism. That's the big reveal. As you start to explore the concept in Jewish thought, it's a completely different concept. Now, on the other hand, and this is equally as important, we need to recognize the question of, why is it so important, right? So why is it so theologically foundational to Jewish life? I'm going to skip this for a moment. If we have time, we'll come back to it, but... If you're joining us for Kohelet, I'll deal with these two pieces when we get to Kohelet as well. It comes back to the concept of Tanakh. What is the subject matter of Tanakh? Subject matter of Tanakh is not what goes on in the heavens. The subject matter of Tanakh is what goes on earth. There's a fascinating verse, the opening verse of the Torah. Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz. Beginning God created heaven and earth. So the Sforno says that the word Shemayim is actually a plural of Shnayim Shavim. Two things that are equal are called Ayim. We have 2 feet, so one is called a regal, and the other, and 2 feet are called Raglayim. You have 2 hands. One is called a Yad, 2 hands are called Yadayim. Right? The Ayim ending, says the Sforno, is a function of plural. So he says that the word Shemayim is a plural of the word Sham. Milat Sham, Torah al-Makom Rachok. It means somewhere far away. And Shemayim means equally far away, double as far away, as removed as possible. And he goes on to say that that's, look at the Torah. The Torah says, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz. The next pasuk says, Ve'aretz et ha-tohu vavohu. Okay, so the land was X, Y, and Z. The Torah never goes back to say, V'yashamayim, the world of Shemayim, the world of the heavens, the world of the domain of the spiritual, the world of godliness. All we know about it is that it exists. We don't go back. The Torah, to Bichtav, the written Torah, doesn't go back to describe what goes on in Shemayim. Right? That half a verse, there's an imbalance in that verse. And so this one says that that's because it's not our issue. It's not the subject of Torah. Oh, the subject of Torah is this world, not the next. All we know is that it exists, just like Tchiyat HaMetim. All we know is that it exists. But beyond that, it's not part of messianism, it's not part of redemption, it's not part of our active effort to redeem our people and to restore Jewish sovereignty to the land of Israel and to the people of Israel, or to place a king of the seed of David on his throne. None of that is part of messianism, part of resurrection of the dead. It's not relevant. On the other hand, and this is really the core of the question, then, why do we even have such a concept? What would be so terrible if... Stop sharing for a second. What would be so implausible if we came along and said, hey, you know what? We believe the soul is immortal. We believe the soul is divine. And therefore, after a person lives his life 120 years in this world, he goes into the next world, he receives his reward and punishment, and that's it. If the Torah doesn't want to discuss the notion of Tchiyat HaMetim because it is a dangerous concept, lest it diminish the value of human life in this world. And if it's not profoundly necessary for the story of Jewish history, as redemption is, right, to restore the Jewish people to the land of Israel and to sovereignty over Israel and Malchut Beit David, that's profoundly important to history. If Tchiyat HaMetim is not profoundly important to history, why is it necessary to believe in Tchiyat HaMitim at all? Why does the Oral Torah make it part of our profound belief? Daniel makes reference to it. Okay. And if we didn't have such a belief, what would be so terrible if all reward was in the next world, not in this world at all? Lose anything by that? So significant. I want to show you how significant this belief in Tchiyat HaMitim is. Here's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Mishnah in Sanhedrin says something extraordinary. Every Israelite has a share in the world to come. Kol Yisrael yesh lam chelek l'olam haba. What the world to come is a whole different question. Okay? Can talk about that too. As it says, Yamech kulam tzadikim l'olam yishu arvet, your people are all righteous and they shall inherit the land for eternity, referring to a spiritual existence. All right. However, says the Mishnah, Elu she'en lam chelek l'olam haba. There are some whose frame of reference and belief system is such that they exclude themselves from a share in the world to come. And they are the following. Ha'omer en tchiyat ha-metim in the Torah. Number one on the list is somebody who denies the concept of tchiyat ha-metim, of the resurrection of the dead. Somebody who denies that the Torah was given by God, an apikoros, whatever an apikoros is defined as, is a major debate. But number one on the list of somebody who loses the share in the world to come is somebody who does not believe that there is such a concept called resurrection of the dead. It's so important, it's so profound, it's so significant that the Mishnah says if you don't believe it, you are excluded from a share in the world to come. That's an extraordinary statement. And the Rambam, same Rambam, in his commentary on the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, meaning where he articulates the 13 principles of faith, writes in what is really a almost out of character extreme reference. He says, "Tchiyat HaMetim Yesod Miyesodot Torat Moshe Rabbeinu." This notion of the revival of the dead is one of the fundamental principles of the Torah. Ein dat ve'ein kesher imuma ha'yehudit lemi she'eno ma'amin v'kach. There is no religion and no attachment to the Jewish religion for one who does not believe in the resurrection, in the restoration of the dead. That's really extraordinary. A concept which has virtually no reference in the written Torah, and intentionally not reference in the written Torah so as not to diminish the value of this life by saying that it's only temporary. There's a single reference in the book of Daniel only because of the need to explain that those who sacrifice their life for Torah in the story of Hanukkah are not, you know, will get their reward in the next world. Olam Haba is a separate concept. Yimot HaMashiach is not relevant to this discussion. Why does the Rambam, why does the Mishnah Sanhedrin go out of its way to say, it's not part of Messianism, it's not part of Jewish redemption, it's not part of the restoration of Israel. And yet, it's so profound, it's so important, that Jewish religion as a whole, the concept of Torah, would unravel if we did not include in the theology of Torah a concept called resurrection of the dead. That's really the extraordinary issue here, right? The tension between what the Torah describes and what Chazal describe in the Oral Torah is you extreme. On the one hand, I hope I sufficiently explained that the written Torah intentionally ignores the concept of the resurrection of the dead. And on the other hand, Chazal said it's so important that if we don't accept it, we unravel the tapestry of Jewish life as a whole. That's the tension we live with. So I want to share with you a possibility. And again, we're in the world of conjecture here. Textual support for what we've discussed in terms of Daniel Perek Yudbet, we've gone beyond. In the world of conjecture, but I have a theory. And I think it has to do with the fact that if I go back to the very first story in Chumash, Let's go back to the very first story in Chumash. There are certain stories at the beginning of Bereshit that have enormous consequences for the unfolding of human history. And yet we never really go back to them and ask the profound questions. So here's Adam and Chava inside the Garden of Eden. They're created, they're placed there. God gives them one mission, which is not to eat of the Eitz HaDaat, whatever that is. The Eitz HaDaat is a symbol of God's authority, says the Nachash. Okay, they violate that one command. V'yomer ha-Nachash el Eishah. What did God say to them? God said to them, actually, let's pull it up for a moment. God had said to them, "Me'etz hadat tov v'ra lo tacham mimenu." The tree of knowledge, whatever the tree of knowledge is, not our subject for now. You shall not eat. Ki biyom ha'chocham mimenu mot tamut. On the day you eat of that tree, you shall surely die. Not all commentaries, but most of the commentaries understand that to mean that in the Garden of Eden, mankind live in a kind of idyllic, almost permanent utopian existence, maybe even immortal, and that by violating the command to eat of the tree of knowledge, which is about God's authority, mankind is expelled from the garden in a way that he becomes mortal. That's how most of the Mefarshim explain it, not all, but certainly most. Then we have a conversation with the Nachash. Whatever the Nachash represents, most likely represents a kind of a symbolic representation of enticement and human and physical drives. But nonetheless, says the Nachash to the Isha as a symbol of denial, lo motumutu. Hey, you're not going to die. Yodea lokim ki biyom acholchem mimenu v'nifkechu enichem. God knows. And on the day you eat of the tree of knowledge, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil, authority over good and evil, however you translate that. Was the Nachash correct? Then on the day we eat of the tree, we will become like God or godly in the sense of authority over good and evil, and that we won't actually die that day? Was the Nachash correct? Was God afraid of competition, so to speak? To a certain extent, the evidence is that the Nachash was correct, because if you look at the end of the story, God now said, now that mankind has become like us, like God, with authority over good and evil, now lest he set forth his hand and take of the tree of life and eat and therefore live forever. And to avoid that circumstance, God expelled him from the garden to work the ground instead of eating of the trees. God banished man from the garden, guarding what was left of the garden, which is the Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life, by the guardian angels of the Kruvim, the cherubs, the Kruvim, that protect against access to the Eitz HaChaim, with their fiery sword in their hands, and mankind is expelled. In other words, the entire foundation of the beginning of Sefer Bereshit starts with the position that there is a direct correlation between chet, sin, mistake, error, violation of God's authority, which is the best way to define chet, and death. And death is the consequence of chet. And from that perspective, if you look at the story of the unfolding of humankind in the next generation, you see that tension, that mankind is now mortal in order to incentivize the human being to begin to recognize mortality as a way of warning them that they need to accept God's authority, right? The Torah is described as the Eitz Chaim Hilam Achazikim Ba. The Torah is described as the tree of life for those who grasp it. The Torah is a way of establishing a kind of eternity of the soul of if you will, right? To return to the Eitz Chaim. But in this world, we live in a world that is imperfect. We live in a world in which mortality exists as a consequence of chet. Now, that's true. There's a problem. What's the problem? This is articulated by Chazal in a very unique way. Says Rabbi Eliezer, person Mishnah Pekevot, Shuv Yom Echad is a good shir for before Elul. V'shuv Yom Echad lifnei mitatcha. One of the things he taught his students, Rabbi Eliezer, was that a person should repent the day before they die. To which his students asked him, but Rabbi, does a person know what day they're going to die? To which he answered and said, how much more so? Should live today as if it is your last, to repent today, lest tomorrow be your last day. And thereby live every day in a sense of awareness of godliness. It's very profound. When the human being is expelled from Gan Eden, what was the average lifespan? The average lifespan of the human being is
1,000 years. 1,000 years.
1,000 years. For 10 generations, more or less, and I'll give you a little bit of a chart here. These are the generations, the 10 generations from Adam to Noach, and more or less the, with one exception of Chanoch, the average lifespan was about 900 years. It's hard to imagine what life would be like if the average lifespan is 900 years. You know, the notion of Rabbi Eliezer that says that we are mortal and therefore we should live every life, every day as if it's our own so that we have meaning in our lives and remain loyal to God. Right? If you're living for 900 years, at one point or another is the boundary between mortality and immortality with a 900-year lifespan is hard to imagine. Just to jump the gun a little bit, Kohelet says this very clearly. Kohelet says that one of the concerns he has in this world is that because man lives for such a long time, they don't see mortality as relevant, especially in our youth. We don't see mortality as relevant to us, and therefore we tend to be more careless. How many, just to put it in practical terms, how many people in their 20s take out a life insurance policy? It's just, we don't live that way. And Kohelet makes the argument, on the contrary, that smach b'chur b'yaldutecha, when you're young, if you want to rejoice and you want to party and you want to have a good time, that's great, right? Do whatever you want. But that, ki akoleli v'echa lokim b'mishpat. But no, that God is going to hold you accountable for everything that you do. And there will come a day, you have to remember your creator, even in your youth, says Kohelet, because we don't live life that way. And there will come a day, when our days of evil come upon us, meaning when we are forced to deal with old age and the consequences of old age, and the sense of mortality comes to haunt us, and then, the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. That one day will come. When do we recognize that? When mankind lives for 900 years? So here's an interesting observation. From Sefer Bereishit perspective, God waits for 10 generations. God allowed 900 years as the lifespan of the human being. What was the consequences after 10 generations? The flood. Correct? Right. So God starts again. What's the average lifespan of the human being after the flood?
100.
About 400.
150, something like that.
No, not quite. Not quite. The first four generations after the flood, the first four generations, the average lifespan is about 400 years.
Okay. But then later on.
And then you have is still too long, because mankind is still not ready to recognize mortality. The next major upheaval in society is the Tower of Babel, which the Torah identifies as taking place during the days of Peleg. And the average lifespan after Peleg is about 200, 150. In other words, every major moment in history in the early generations of Sefer Breshit halves the average lifespan of the human being. And part of that message is exactly the message of the Gan Eden. We were removed from Gan Eden because of the consequences of the actions of the Nachash, whatever that means. And we needed to live with the sense of mortality in order to regain our sense of loyalty to God. So let me ask the question in a very simple, profound way. If the resurrection of the dead as a concept didn't exist, and human being remained mortal forever, did the Nachash win? From a perspective of Sefer Breishit, the earliest story we have in Chumash, death enters into the conversation because of the consequences of the Nachash. So I do believe, this is kind of how I process it, that there is a concept called Triyat HaMetim, which exists. It's not an active concept. It's not something we process in the concept of messianism. It's not something we actively work towards. We're not living our lives in order to be able to accomplish something in the world of the resurrection of the dead. It's just there. It exists. But why is it so important? I think it's so important because it essentially argues that whatever the Nachash achieved in the story of Gan Eden is temporary, and that ultimately God will navigate the world to a restoration of the story of Gan Eden. And so that's a profoundly important concept. That the Nachash should not be the one to emerge from the story of Gan Eden victorious. And Triyat HaMetim takes us back into the world of the Eitz HaChaim, into the world of Gan Eden, into the world of, and in fact, we call it Gan Eden, right? In literature of rabbinic literature, that world is called Gan Eden. We'll talk about a person who should have a licht Gan Eden, right? Should have a life in Gan Eden. We call it Gan Eden. And we do so because of that reference back to the world of the moment before the Nachash achieved what he accomplished in the human society. That's a concept. It exists. It's there. It's a theology. It's part of our belief system. But it does not impact how we live our daily lives. How we live our daily lives is based on Torah, and reward and punishment on a national scale is called messianism. On an individual scale is called Olam Haba. Completely different issue. And we're going to unpack that in great detail in our study of Kohelet. But the concept of Triyat HaMetim exists. That I think is important, because without it, we lose sense of the fact that the Nachash won in Gan Eden. And that's that from a theological perspective is intolerable. At some point, we believe that God will navigate the world back to that moment of Gan Eden pre the impact of the Nachash. And with that, we will draw a close to our study of Sefer Daniel. I hope you've enjoyed the journey, and it's been my pleasure to share it with you. I'm going to pause now if people have brief questions. And a reminder again, there is no class next week. We're taking a 1-week break. And then you will all be invited to join. You'll have to re-register. We're all invited to join our journey through the study of the Book of Kohelet, which will start, B'ezrat Hashem, 2 weeks from today. Thank you.
Rabbi, great journey.
Wonderful. You're going to come back in Kohelet on Tzadik Baral or Shabbat Tovlo.
Yes, that is correct. That is going to be a major theme of Kohelet.
You made me wonder whether the Gevir of Yosef, which Binyamin allegedly stole, represents the reward and punishment concept of the Nachash.
Huh?
How does the Gavia come to Nachash?
Yosef was contemplating the mortality of the Bnei Israel.
I have to think about that. I'm not sure what the consequences of that would be. I'd have to think about that. Interesting idea. Interesting.
Thank you so much for a brilliant lecture.
My pleasure. But my pleasure. Yes.
Rabbi?
Yes.
You said that one of the features of Gan Eden was human immortality. Did I hear that correctly?
That is, it's debated amongst the Rishonim, but it seems to be the simple reading of the text is that in Gan Eden, mankind was immortal until they ate of the tree, and then God removed them from Gan Eden in order to remove that mortality from them, immortality from them.
Because it seems like God is worried that they, lest they eat from the tree of life. So
that's how
already...
it's phrased. That's exactly how it's phrased. It's essentially phrased in a way in which the eating of the tree of life is what gives immortality or immortality. But the way I understand it is that that's simply a, these are more symbolic than practical, but that they are, that his existence in the world of Gan Eden was one in which that's how I understand the phrase, on the day you eat the tree, you will die. Meaning, I will remove you from Gan Eden so that you will encounter death. That's how I understand.
I see. Well, thank you very much for a brilliant series. And I want you to know that I know several Tanakh teachers who won't touch Sefer Daniel because they say they don't understand it at all. So at least we have a glimpse of how to understand it. Thank you. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. I learned it from Ramadan. I think it's... I owe everything that I in terms of Tanakh to my teachers, so I share that with you, and that's my excuse for it. Thank you.
Would you say that Rashi's interpretation of Tchiyat HaMetin as being messianic is the one that's normative, or would you?
No,
say
I actually think that the irony here is that I think the normative is actually the Rambam. But I think what's more popularly perceived is Rashi. But if you look at the sources, the normative position is that of the Rambam. It's interesting. I think what's more popular is Rashi's perspective, that it's part of messianism. But that's in part because we tend to teach Chumash with a Rashi bias. And that's problematic. I mean, it's not problematic. It's good, but we need to know Rashi. But there are other interpretations besides Rashi. So certainly in this regard, there are many concepts of messianism that we see through the lens of Rashi, the notion that the third temple will come down in a fire from heaven, right? That's also Rashi. Most Rishonim disagree. But from a normative perspective, Rashi is an exception. I think the normative perspective is usually that of the Rambam. All right. Thank you all for your time. Thank you for listening. And we will see you all, please God, in 2 weeks' time.
Thank you.
Excellent. It was worth the wait.
My pleasure.
Hey, Rabbi.
Yes.
Since the snake is created by God and punished by God and his form changes by God, I don't see how, even if we didn't have the Tchiyat HaMetim, that the snake would win, because we know he's the subject of God and, God is his ruler. And it doesn't make a difference. God shows himself to be superior.
Yeah, so yes, and I agree with that in terms of again, much has to be. I've just given you a 5-minute review of a course on Bereshit, but I'm not sure. First of all, that the form of the snake has changed. I think the snake represents something in the garden. I think it represents the notion of physical drives and temptation. And ultimately, what happens in the by removing Adam and Chava from Gan Eden, that's the victory to a big victory, small victory to the world of temptation of physicality. And so from a theological perspective, there's actually, we're going to talk about in Kohelet and much more, because in Kohelet, we're going to talk about the relationship between Gan Eden and the temple and the Kodesh HaKadoshim and the Kruvim and the Eitz Chaim is symbolized by the Aron and the Torah. And what essentially the Torah is saying is embrace Torah, right? Embrace the Eitz Chaim in order to anchor yourself in a way back to Gan Eden. But there has to be a way back to Gan Eden, at least theologically. That's the way I understand it. All right. More to, we'll unpack it a little bit more in our study of Kohelet, I hope. But for now, I'm going to let everybody go. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. And we will see you, B'ezrat Hashem, in a couple of weeks.